One of the things that's interesting, Dave read a passage from Deuteronomy, actually focused on Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5, which has become known as the Shema. It is kind of the groundwork, the basis, the bulwark of the Jewish faith and the reality of biblical faith. People sometimes forget about the Old Testament and don't think about the Old Testament in terms of relevance. It's one of the reasons why we do series through books of the Old Testament from time to time. The Old Testament is incredibly relevant. When Jesus was tempted, and the book of Deuteronomy, despite what some people think, is incredibly relevant. When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, we all know that he quoted scripture in response to the devil's kind of taunts and temptations. Where he quoted scripture from was from the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is one of the most often quoted books by Jesus. When he's asked about the greatest commandment, he refers back to the Shema. And when his disciples and he quote Old Testament, very often they quote from the book of Deuteronomy. We can't unhitch from the Old Testament. The Old Testament is relevant. It's why we talk about it. It's why we go through it. We're going through an Old Testament book now. We're going through the book of Nehemiah. And I've entitled the message today, Time to Get Busy, because Nehemiah has gone on. We're at kind of midpoint through chapter 2, and Nehemiah has been on a journey. We're about to see him come into Jerusalem and kind of start to get busy with what the mission that God has given to him. So we'll look at a map here for a second, because I want to do some kind of backtracking a little bit to kind of cover some ground that I don't think I covered quite enough going into it. This trip is when we're talking about going from the winter capital of the Persian world in Susa to Jerusalem. Now, many people will ask, isn't it a far more direct route to just go straight across? Well, you can see by the little bubbles down there that would mean leaving Persia and going into a different kind of empire. And that's not a good thing in that day. You're talking about a very kind of troubled area right now. This is on the southern border of the Medo-Persian Empire, and there's trouble, at least potential. In this day and this time, on through the Roman Empire, the southern and northern borders of an empire are dangerous territory. That's the ground that's been taken generally last. That's the furthest away from power centers from the government, and hardest to manage, hardest to man, hardest to staff, hardest to get supplies to. So there's always potential upheaval there. But this journey that Nehemiah goes on from Susa to Jerusalem is about 1,500 miles. And it will take them between 4 and 6 months to get from Susa to Jerusalem, depending on who you listen to. Maybe a little bit less than that, but it's a long, arduous journey. It's a journey that Nehemiah has entered into because of some things that are really super important for us to think about in this process. We tend to kind of, or I tend to kind of skip over or glide over why this is such a big deal. We talked about it a little bit in the first message, which was that in the time of David and Solomon, Israel had been a united empire. It was a united kingdom, not so much an empire, but more of a kingdom. There came a point when it split. It split into two parts. One part is the northern tribes, which became Israel. The southern part, made up of two tribes, is referred to as Judah. Israel kind of went into idolatry very, very quickly. Judah was a little bit slower to the party, but they came to the party. They came and got involved in idolatry and that sort of stuff. Kind of a sewer in terms of a slide down a slope. But then we've got some superpowers that rise up. The first is the Assyrians, and they come and take out the northern kingdom, Israel. And they do what the Babylonians, who will ultimately conquer the southern kingdom, do as well. They decide that the way to break apart a society is to take certain kind of important parts of it: faith, culture, societal connection, leadership, those kinds of things, and remove those from the equation. Their philosophy, and it was a brutal but effective one, is you can come in and literally destroy the fabric of a society by removing and doing away with key parts of it. And one of the things that they did was take the Jewish people and put them into, disperse them, put them into exile. This is the exilic or the exile age of the Jewish people. They are scattered. Many people would say they are still scattered in some ways. The nation of Israel has been restored, but in this time, in this place, you've got groups of people who had been effectively royalty, who were in leadership, who were leaders in a community, who were wealthy and powerful, and are now out in the hinterlands basically as laborers. What they were is gone, and that's the point for the Assyrians and the Babylonians. We take these components of culture and wipe them out. And this is the world that Nehemiah is looking at. Nehemiah is looking at a world that now he's under the Persians who've reversed a lot of this, but he's looking at a scattered people. Now, one of the things that I want to touch on briefly is when you look at the philosophy and the theory of leadership for the Assyrians and the Babylonians in particular, destroying, getting control over people by destroying the fabric of society. Sound familiar? Sound like something that might be going on in our day? Get at religion, get at focus on God, get at the things and destroy the fabric of society and maintain control as a result of it. Take the things that are important to people and cast them aside. Look, we're in a day and a time and a culture where people will say, well, how can you say that? What do you mean idolatry? What do you mean that we don't have an adulterous society? Look around us. Cars, money, sex, drugs, idol, 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 idol. If you can destroy the fabric of society, if you can destroy the moral fabric of society, if you can get people off into a corner, it used to be that people would at a minimum tolerate and in many cases respect people who were people of faith. Now you're reviled. Now you're ridiculed. Now you're intolerant. You're stupid. You're whatever, fill in the blank. At this point, we have to take a stand. And we have to look at what I believe that Nehemiah is about, which is rebuilding. And we have to look at the importance of what's going on with Nehemiah in terms of rebuilding. We are in Babylon right now. We have to rebuild. We have to get busy. The Persians are the third group that has come in, and they take a different approach than the Assyrians and the Babylonians. King Cyrus, who is the first leader of the Persian Empire, once the takeover takes place, reversed the policies of the Assyrians and Babylonians, and in about 538 BC, he allowed the conquered people who had been forcibly displaced from their lands to return. And as part of God's providence, the exiles from Israel and Judah were allowed to return to the promised land. And they come back in three waves. We talked about this before, but they come back in three waves. The first is under Zerubbabel. And we see the account of this in Ezra chapters 1 through 6. The second wave takes place about 70 years later under Ezra the priest. It's under his leadership. And this is the period reflected in Zechariah, Haggai, and Malachi. Then there is the third wave some years later, which is where we're at now, under Nehemiah. Now, it's important to understand that originally, I mean, there's some confusing things about this book. Number one, its placement in our physical Bible. We tend to think that we go from page one to page whatever it is in your Bible, beginning to end. And we're going in a sequence and we're going in a logical progression. Nehemiah is not middle of the Old Testament. Nehemiah, more properly, is the last storytelling book of the Old Testament. When Nehemiah comes to a close, the curtain falls, and we are waiting for the Messiah. It's kind of the end of the Old Testament story in some ways. So it's a little confusing that it appears physically earlier in the Bible. It's also true that Ezra and Nehemiah were at one point one book, and then they were broken apart because they tell a story of this second and third wave and the rebuilding of a wall and a rebuilding of a city and a rebuilding of a people. Nehemiah was not a priest. He was not a Bible or scripture teacher. Nehemiah was an administrator, and he is a very good administrator. He is a leader. And he is the cupbearer of Artaxerxes, a position of power, and a position of power that was orchestrated by God. This is a big kingdom. You can see by the map, there's a lot going on here. There are a lot of people, there's a lot of places, there's a lot of traveling to do, and Artaxerxes is in control of this stuff. And his cupbearer, the person who tastes his food to make sure he's not going to be poisoned, nice job, by the way. If the king has been poisoned, you're the first to know because you're the one who dies. But Nehemiah's risen far beyond just the taster of food. He's a valued, trusted companion. And we kind of saw that in the way Artaxerxes deals with him throughout this first part of the book. This is much more than just somebody who's tasting my food. This is somebody I trust, and quite frankly, somebody I care about. We have seen Nehemiah experience the hand of God, and we've seen his reaction to the news that his brother brought him of what was going on in Jerusalem. What has happened to the people, the state that they're in. This is a nation, a people that is still reeling from being in exile. Their spirits have been broken. This has been a long time of being under the jackboot of other governments. They are beginning to wonder if there is ever hope that they will be restored as God's people in God's land. And that's what Nehemiah sees going on. Nehemiah does, after his brother tells him what's going on, the first thing that every leader should do, pray. And pray fervently. And pray, as we talked about, for a four-month period of time, fasting and prayer. Not playtime, he's fasting and praying. He is all about the people of God, which is unusual to some extent, because he's not a priest. He's not a person that you would logically look at and say, this is the guy that is going to lead the people. And you watch. I'm just going to point out to you. You watch what God does over and over and over again. Because it's easy to say, I look at Nehemiah, and Nehemiah doesn't appear on the outset like the guy who's going to lead this kind of thing. Yes, he's skilled as an administrator. He might be somebody that would kind of be under the spiritual guy that comes in and leads this revival. He might be the second in command, but he's at the top of the heap. Look at who God has used up to this point and will use over and over again. Because I'm going to suggest something to you. At first glance, Moses probably wasn't the guy that you'd look at to lead a nation out of captivity. And yet he's exactly the guy that God uses to lead a nation out of captivity and take them out of from under the jackboot of Egypt. God chooses people, and then he gifts them and empowers them and uses them for incredible things. Then Nehemiah asks Artaxerxes for permission to go to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall. But in Nehemiah's mind, he is not just rebuilding a physical city. He was really about rebuilding the people of God. So now let's look at our text for today, which will be Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 9 through 20. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, It displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. Okay, it's up for these guys. We will talk about this more in a second, but these guys had appealed to Artaxerxes many years earlier and basically said, these guys are trying to rebuild this city. They're not any good. If you allow them to rebuild this city, you're not going to get any money. You're not going to get any revenue. You're going to lose power. You're going to lose control. And you'll see just how evil and perverse these Jews are. So you better stop them. And the king does. So when Nehemiah goes to Artaxerxes and asks for permission to rebuild the wall in Jerusalem, he's asking Artaxerxes to reverse an order he'd entered previously. No small feat, no small task. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, and I and a few men with me. Now it's important, and we'll talk about this more. Those men who go with Nehemiah are never identified, by name anyway. We don't know if they're part of a group that came with him to Jerusalem, or if they were people in Jerusalem that, for whatever reason, he knew would be of assistance to him. I believe it's in the second category. I don't believe that these guys are from outside of Jerusalem, because he's reconnoitering. He's going in and looking at this wall. So it makes sense to me that he would want to go with people he could trust who are from that area, who would know the condition of things. And I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon gate and to the dung gate. I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall. And I turned back and entered the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. Nehemiah is a guy who is more than willing to meet and beat any challenge that he faces. And he's willing to meet and beat this challenge because of his time in prayer. He's fervent about one thing in particular, and that's that this matters. It matters to God, and it matters to the people of Israel. He's got some things going against him. Obviously, he's a Jew. He's a Jew in exile. But he has listened to God, and he knows what God has for him to do. Then he meets the challenge of convincing Artaxerxes to let him go to Jerusalem and rebuild the city and the wall, because it involved the king reversing an order. Now, people will ask, why is a wall such a big deal? Why is it such a big deal to the Jewish people that there was effectively no wall around the city of Jerusalem? Well, because a wall was critically important in that time in terms of commerce, in terms of peace, in terms of a sense of security. If you didn't have a wall, you were open to attack from anybody anytime. They could come at you and do whatever they want. No one would do trade of any kind in a city that didn't have a wall, because their goods could be plundered at any point in time. Challenges are met. And now on to something even more difficult, rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. So why is it job so tough? Why do people tend to focus on this job of rebuilding the wall around the city of Jerusalem and refer to it as difficult as it really was? Commentators disagree on the size of the city of Jerusalem at this time, and therefore they disagree over the length. But even the most conservative estimates are that the circumference of the city was 1.5 to 2.5 miles. So you're talking about building and rebuilding, and in many cases, rebuilding is harder than building because you're moving rubble and replacing things that had burnt, been torn down. 2.5 miles is not just a little bit of damage to the wall. It was totally destroyed, and it's not just a little wall. This is a wall that's supposed to be a wall that will protect the city. And these guys don't have any heavy equipment. They don't have machinery. And yet Nehemiah will rebuild this wall in, wait for it, 52 days. Anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 mile wall, and Nehemiah will drive a project to rebuild this wall in 52 days. 52 days. Not a big deal. Have we driven down I-5 recently? Right out here by Tacoma? How long have we been working on that traffic project? I think it's been longer than 52 days. And I think it involves, Nehemiah's project involves more than, look, I remember the days when, if you guys remember, when they were connecting I-5 to Highway 16. They'd rebuilt the Narrows Bridge. They'd done a lot of different things, and they were connecting it. And I want to say that the engineers that were working on Highway 16 and the engineers that were working on I-5 to connect them were 18 inches off. One was 18 inches higher than the other. And so they had to knock down a huge section. So when we look at what Nehemiah is accomplishing in 52 days, with what he had and the tools that he had, you almost wish he was working on I-5 because he accomplished tremendous things. And Nehemiah also faced a problem of history. This was a job that had been attempted before. The work had started in the second year of King Cyrus, which is 538 BC, more than 90 years before Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem. It took that first group, that first wave that came into Jerusalem, once Cyrus had reversed the kind of Babylonian and Assyrian orders, it took them 15 years to finish the temple. 15 years. Then the attempt to rebuild the wall. Opposition arose from the governors of the Trans-Euphrates. An appeal was made to Artaxerxes, and the work was stopped. And that stoppage of that work had taken place 13 years before Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem. Jim Collins has written a book called Good to Great. Some of you may be familiar with it. But one of the things that Jim Collins talks about is the need to build, if there's going to be progress, if a project is going to be completed and completed successfully, inertia has to take place. He talks about it in terms of moving the flywheel. That the flywheel has to start moving, and then ultimately it will start to pick up speed and inertia will take hold. And that can take time. And the locals are discouraged and defeated, and there is a risk for them in getting on board with a guy that they know nothing about. I mean, nobody knows anything about Nehemiah. He's their new governor. He's been appointed by a Persian king to come in and effectively rule over them. They probably know that he's of Jewish descent, but they were used to dealing with a whole lot of people who claimed Jewish descent who weren't particularly loyal to the Jewish faith. And many of them had moved off into idolatry, and so this is not a group of people that is particularly focused on God at this point. So they don't expect that Nehemiah is particularly focused on God. It seems like an absolutely overwhelming task. And that is where truly great leaders shine. Let's look a little bit deeper dive into a couple of verses here. Verses 9 and 10. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent me with officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. Imagine that scene, if you will. Here's the guys that have put a stop to all this. And you have to understand, Nehemiah's been very, very careful. He hasn't come rolling into town with a fanfare. There's not a parade. People aren't throwing flowers. He's very quietly coming into town. He's coming into this area. They don't know what's happening because he doesn't want them to know what's happening. They probably at least think about waving their letters from Artaxerxes to say, hey, better not think about doing anything in Jerusalem. And there's Nehemiah to say, sorry, boys, got some new letters. There's a new sheriff in town. It's me. And your letters were they're outdated. This can't be a pleasant thing for these guys. He's the one now. He's the one that's undid their dirty work, and he's the one with the letters about Jerusalem. And oh, by the way, just in case you're wondering if I have the king's favors, meet my pals, the soldiers and the cavalry, that are here with me to protect me. Oh, that you're mad and upset? If you have any questions, ask, talk to them. They'll take care of it for you. Favor, yes. Providence of God, most definitely. Now, this is an important trip for Artaxerxes as well. I mean, we talked about it when we looked at the map. This is kind of in the outer reaches of a land that's in a little bit of upheaval and is not exactly stable. So one of the things that he really needs is a governor of this province that is really good and really good at managing people and situations. And guess who his boy in that context is? That'd be Nehemiah. So Nehemiah is asked to go to Jerusalem. It also serves Artaxerxes' purposes to send him there. The providence of God. Whether Artaxerxes realizes why he's sending Nehemiah or not does not matter, because God wants Nehemiah in Jerusalem. And so that providence will be carried out. Nehemiah is taking action. It's one of the bricks of godly leadership that we talked about. He also isn't worried about opposition, which was another brick that we talked about. When we are told that Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite heard about Nehemiah's plans, it displeased them greatly. That's one of those understatements in the Bible. When it says it displeased them greatly, these guys are hacked off. They're not happy. They're really, really angry. Does that slow Nehemiah down at all? No. Why? Well, because he was expecting it. Because a good leader expects opposition at some level. And that's probably because he expected it is why he was very clear with Artaxerxes that he wanted letters. He wanted specific guidance. He wanted evidence that he could hold in the face of these guys and say, there's a new sheriff in town. I'm the new governor here. You will follow my lead, not the other way around. He's on a mission from God. Verses 11 through 15. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night, by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall, and I turned back and entered the valley gate and so returned. Nehemiah makes it very clear. He's in Jerusalem for 3 days before he starts anything. What do you think he's doing? Well, yeah, he's probably resting. It's been a 1,500-mile journey. But I don't think that's the focus of what he's doing. We've seen enough about Nehemiah to know that Nehemiah is going to do one thing when he gets there. Nehemiah is going to pray. Nehemiah is going to fervently pray. God, guide my steps. What do you want me to do? What should I do first? He is going to be in prayer. He could have come into the city with fanfare. He's there to assume power after all. He's the new governor. Power given to him by King Artaxerxes. And then he does something unusual but effective. He goes out with some guys he trusts at night when nobody else is around and sets out to see just what the situation is and how badly the wall is damaged. He was gathering the information necessary to formalize his plan as part of his vision for rebuilding the city. Look, Nehemiah knows something that everybody that's involved in these kinds of things comes to know at some point. Information is necessary. But what you really need is the necessary information. Too many times people will get paralyzed because they're looking for all the information. They get mired in the minutiae. Something that effective leaders will always try to avoid. It is what's referred to sometimes as paralysis by analysis. There's a management and marketing kind of guru by the name of Seth Godin, and he talks about one of his catchphrases is, you've got to ship it. And what that basically means is there's going to come a point where you have to realize it may not be perfect, you may not have everything you need, but it's good enough, and it needs to get out. There needs to be movement on it. You can't leave it in the factory until you think it's perfect, because the time will come, it will be passed, it will no longer be relevant, and somebody else will beat you to the punch in the marketing and business context. We have to have information, but we have to understand that we won't ever have all the information. We just have to have the intuition to know what's the necessary information. Some people never take action because of a desire to keep gathering information until you have all the information, which, by the way, will never happen. Effective leaders focus on gathering the necessary information. Nehemiah did not have all the information, but after this exploratory trip around the city, he had enough information to form a sound, workable plan for commencing the work of rebuilding the wall. He had the vision, he had the concept, and now he's got the beginnings of a plan. Why does Nehemiah go at night? When things are done in the Bible at night, if you look at it, there's a pattern. It tends to be, secrecy tends to be a component, a big component. It's at least one of the goals. So Nehemiah goes at night for probably two reasons. First, he doesn't want his enemies to know. He wants to get the jump on them. He wants to be either finished with or well into this project. I mean, this is the version of that time of Operation Warp Speed. When you talk about rebuilding miles of wall in 52 days, this is something getting after it. And he doesn't want these guys to be able to take another run at Artaxerxes, stir up more trouble, because he knows that Artaxerxes, while he had favor with Artaxerxes, Artaxerxes has kind of a pattern and a history of placating people. So if these guys come up and make a big stink and send out another letter, there's at least a possibility that another edict from Artaxerxes is going to come down saying, stop the work. And at that point in time, the people of Israel will be destroyed. Any desire to be rebuilt as a nation will be gone. So he doesn't want that to happen. Secondly, Nehemiah wants to come up with a workable plan before the Jews could develop an argument as to why they could not rebuild the wall. I mean, one of the things that people have to understand is that if you're going to come into a situation, people expect, if they're going to follow you, they expect to see a plan. They expect to see something. They expect to think, to know that there's at least some possibility that this is going to come to pass. When we talked about Camp Hope, we talked about it wasn't just the outline on a napkin from Woods Coffee in Linden. It was more that this is what, these are the people we've talked to. This is how much it's going to cost. This is where the money's going to come from. This is the people that are going to be involved. These are the kinds of things we're going to teach. This is the conversation we've had with Mary Lyon. And then it's easier to have people kind of look at that and say, okay, sounds like it might work. Let's move forward. What happens so many different times is people have a tendency to come in and say, look, this is my vision. This is what I think. And if we don't do it, I think we're being disobedient, kind of bringing God in as a cosigner. Now, that's not something that Nehemiah would say. It sounds like something that I would say and have said in the past and learned the lesson, not the hard way, the gentle way, that, look, if people are going to understand, and Nehemiah knows this, if people are going to understand where you're going, where you want to go, and what you want to do, here's my plan, and oh, by the way, here's the favor of God that's been with me along the way. There will be times, and Nehemiah will face times, where he's got to look at people and say, look, trust me. God's with us. God's given me direction on this. This is the direction we need to head. But Nehemiah knows you can't do that every time. People have to see that there's a plan. And Nehemiah wants to make sure that he has the information necessary to put that plan together before he goes to the people of Israel, so they can see what's going on and they can see that they can buy into what's going on. But when there is what appears to be a workable plan, people will respond positively, as we see in verses 17 and 18. Further evidence of Nehemiah's skill and wisdom as a leader. Now Nehemiah will have to implement his plan, which means he will have to overcome the discouragement and apathy of the people of Jerusalem. Look, this is something they've been through before. They've heard stories about the people before them having been through it. They have been looked at with derision by everybody around Jerusalem for as long as they can possibly remember. None of this has ever worked before. And now this new guy, Nehemiah, comes in saying, hey, follow me, let's go. It's all going to change. It's going to be great. They aren't in that place mentally or spiritually at that point. There's a great English historian, a guy named Arnold Toynbee. And this is what he has to say. Apathy can only be overcome by enthusiasm, and enthusiasm can only be aroused by two things. First, an ideal which takes the imagination by storm, and second, a definite, intelligible plan for carrying that ideal into practice. People have to see the leader's vision. They have to believe it. They have to catch it. But they also need to know there is a realistic plan of bringing it to pass. And that's exactly what Nehemiah is about. Nehemiah has spent the first 3 days resting and praying. Then he surveys the city. He develops his plan. And then on the fourth day, presents his plan to the people. He doesn't want to lose momentum because he sees that the flywheel is starting to turn. Verses 16 through 18. And the officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer suffer derision. Nehemiah does something there super cool and really incredible. Do you notice the language that Nehemiah is using? It's not you, it's us. It's not you, it's we. This is the trouble we're in. This is what's happened to us. Hey guys, I'm right in the middle of this thing with you. I'm not some guy from the outside that doesn't really care about us. This is about us. This is about our people. This is about we. You see the trouble we are in. Another key to effective leadership. How Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us, I'm going to do this with you, build the wall of Jerusalem. that we may no longer suffer derision. Look, I know what you've gone through. I know why this is so important to you. I know what you've experienced. You are the lowest of the low in this culture. I get it. I'm the cupbearer of the king. And yeah, that gives me some authority, but let's not lose sight, boys and girls, of what the cupbearer means. I'm a slave. I taste his food first. And if somebody's trying to kill him, guess who's going to die? That's me. So I get where you're coming from. And this is about us, and this is about rebuilding us as a people. And Nehemiah follows up this challenge to them by making it clear why this will work. Because the hand of God was upon him and upon his vision. And as proof of that, just look at the experience or the favor I've experienced with the king. Checkmate. God is at work in this. Look, see, here it is. A leader will get nowhere with me and you. Look, if you try, people often think that the way to motivate things, people, is with external stuff. And generally in the business world, they think that the external stuff that motivates people is money. And I suppose you can make an argument that people do things for money, but never in the long run. People are never truly motivated by external things. It's always the internal things that really, truly motivate people. If you want to talk about you, you're not going to motivate anybody to anything. But people will break through a burning wall for us and we. For a vision and for a unity in that vision and in that leadership, it matters. He challenged the people of Jerusalem to build so that we will no longer be in derision. And some translations don't use the word derision, they use the word disgrace. And that's really what it means. Look, we've had an awful long time of being in a season of disgrace. That's why I'm here. I came 1,500 miles over a period of months, asked the king to reverse an order that he'd entered because I turned to God, I looked to God, and I know that this is much more about building and rebuilding a city wall. It's about rebuilding a people. And it matters to me and it matters to God, and I want it to matter to you. We've been in disgrace. It's time that that end. And what was the response to Nehemiah's challenge? And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. Okay, time to get busy. Verses 19 through 20. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered us and despised us and said, what is this thing that you are doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Then I replied to them, the God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem. This is God's town, and you got right. Shut up. Hush. Shut up. Hush sounds much better than shut up. My grandfather always used to say, hush, hush. In other words, shut up. So here they come again. Tobiah the Ammonite, and now with him is Geshem the Arab, and they are jeering, mocking, and despising. And they try to play the rebelling against the king card again. Nehemiah's seen that. He's seen it coming. That's what they did the first time to get the work stopped. They're rebelling against you. And he knows he'll probably do it again. Why he wants to get done quickly, why he wanted the letters, why he wanted the king's full blessing. If you think you're not going to face opposition, guess again. It almost always comes. And don't let it make you question your plan. Always be listening and be ready to pivot. That's necessary and prudent. Look, there is no plan that isn't subject to being changed. There is no plan. When you're doing restructurings and turnarounds in a business in crisis or anything else, you have to be ready to pivot in a moment's notice. And it may be that what you were doing was okay. There's just not enough time for it to work. So you got to try something else. And if you stick by your guns and say, nope, that's my plan. I know it's right. And I'm in my way or the highway. And that's what you do. It's destruction. So you have to be ready to pivot, to turn. Not to compromise, but to listen and to see the circumstances, because the circumstances may be changing in front of your eyes. But understand that the plans that the enemy will come against are not the bad plans. The enemy doesn't care about a plan that is ridiculous. The plans the enemy cares about are the plans that are the good plans. The plans that are developed by after God. The plans to rebuild a city and rebuild a people is a plan that he's going to use the people who have selfish motivation in order to come against it. They want Nehemiah to question himself, his plan, and his loyalty to the king, and he's having none of it. He reminds them who it is that he truly serves, and that's God. And that through God, their plans will prosper. The wall will be rebuilt, and along with it, the people of Jerusalem and of Israel. And the naysayers are going to have no say in any way, in any part of the plan, or what is going to come to pass. If you look at the big picture of what's going on with Nehemiah, I want us to think about what we talked about at the outset this morning, talking about the background of this book and talking about where we are in this world, that we are in Babylon. I would suggest to you that we're in the same kind of situation that Nehemiah was looking into. We are looking into a world, and let's face facts. There's a lot of people in churches today that are very discouraged, that have literally watched culture run over the top of them, that have watched biblical inerrancy, biblical truth get minimized and marginalized, that have listened to people talk about unhitching from the Old Testament, that have talked about, and the reason we're talking about unhitching from the Old Testament is because we don't want to deal with the hard stuff in the Old Testament. We want to be able to attack inerrancy of the Bible because we don't like the hard stuff. We don't like to talk about hell. We don't like to talk about the hard stuff. We don't want to talk about the hard stuff. We want to talk about the fun stuff. We want to sing songs that are just pleasant and happy and wonderful, sunshine and roses and unicorns in the sky. That's what we want to talk about. We don't want the derision that the people of Israel were faced. We don't want the ridicule. We don't want the rejection. We don't want to deal with the abuse that comes from a culture that is against everything that our God has given us to follow in his book. Dave talked about Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 5, the greatest commandment, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, your strength, and your mind. That's the first and greatest commandment. We are in a culture that says, love yourself with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. You're the most important. It's about me. I'm what matters. If that goes against what you want, well, it's about me. It's all about me. Jerusalem was in a state of disrepair, destruction. The people were being derided, ridiculed by the world around them. And we are in many ways looking at the same kind of thing. Culture is a problem. It's a big problem. But we can't run away from culture and hide. We have to press in. We have to stand. It is time to rebuild. Lord, I thank you for today. I thank you for the many blessings that you've bestowed upon us. Lord, I pray that you would give us the strength to deal with the things in our culture and our society that need to be dealt with. Give us direction. Give us guidance. Show us how to tell a world that needs to know about you. Help us to rebuild. Rebuild in our own lives and in the lives of those around us. Help us to always have our focus on you and never on ourselves. And I just pray these things in your name, Lord Jesus. Amen.